From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Let me be very clear. We will defend our people. We will act. Iran will soon feel the consequences of their actions. The response will be painful.
Israel's vowing to retaliate after Iran fires at least 180 ballistic missiles targeting Israeli military and security sites. As Israel sends more ground troops to invade southern Lebanon, we'll go to Tel Aviv and Washington. Then J.D. Vance and Tim Walz face off last night in the only vice presidential debate before the election. They sparred on Middle East policy, abortion, climate change, immigration, and Donald Trump's attempt to overturn the 2020 election.
Did he lose the 2020 election?
Tim, I'm focused on the future. Did Kamala Harris censor Americans from speaking their mind in the wake of the 2020 COVID situation?
That is a damning non-answer.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed to retaliate after Iran fired at least 180 ballistic missiles at Israel in response to repeated Israeli attacks on Lebanon and the assassination of several Hezbollah leaders, including Hassan Nasrallah. Video posted online shows some of the missiles striking at or near the Nevatim Air Base, which houses Israel's U.S.-made F-35 fighter jets. Israel says the only death from the attacks was a Palestinian man who was killed by falling debris in the occupied West Bank in Jericho. At the White House, President Biden responded by saying the United States will help Israel, quote, exact severe consequences, unquote. On Tuesday, a Pentagon spokesperson said U.S. forces had aided Israel in thwarting Iran's attack.
During the attack, the U.S. military coordinated closely with the Israeli Defense Forces to help defend Israel. U.S. Navy destroyers deployed to the Middle East region supported the defense of Israel by firing approximately a dozen interceptors against the incoming Iranian missiles.
In Tel Aviv, Israeli police said at least seven people died in a shooting and stabbing attack on Tuesday. Israeli authorities claim the attack was carried out by two people from the occupied West Bank. One was shot dead, the other seriously wounded. In Lebanon, Hezbollah says its fighters have repelled incursions by Israeli forces attempting to invade southern Lebanon. Israeli media reports at least two Israeli soldiers were killed, 18 others wounded near the Lebanese border town of Odessa. Meanwhile, Israel's military ordered more residents of Beirut's southern suburbs to evacuate their homes. The UN says more than a million people across Lebanon have been uprooted by Israel's assault. In the Gaza Strip, Palestinian health officials say Israeli attacks have killed more than 79 Palestinians, wounding 82 others over the past 24 hours. In one strike, Israeli fighter jets bombed a school-turned-shelter in Gaza City's Tufah neighborhood, killing at least 13 people, including children. Israeli forces also bombed the Al Amal orphanage west of Gaza City, killing six Palestinians and wounding many others. Here in New York, vice presidential nominees Tim Walz and J.D. Vance faced off in their first and only debate ahead of November's election. The two clashed when Walz questioned Vance about Trump's claims that the 2020 election was stolen.
Still saying he didn't lose the election. I would just ask that. Did he lose the 2020 election?
Tim, I'm focused on the future. Did Kamala Harris censor Americans from speaking their mind in the wake of the 2020 COVID situation?
That is a damning non-answer.
Senator Vance took aim at Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris's record on border security, while Walz condemned Donald Trump over abortion rights. Their sparring over abortion came as a new law took effect in Louisiana that reclassifies the abortion medications mifepristone and misoprostol, listing them as controlled dangerous substances. The first of its kind law in the country makes it a crime punishable by up to 5 years in prison to possess the medications without a prescription. In Ukraine, authorities have declared a day of mourning in the southern city of Kherson, where a Russian attack on a market killed 6 people and wounded more than 10 others. Elsewhere, at least one person was killed and 32 injured when Russia bombed residential buildings and infrastructure in the southern Zaporizhia region. In eastern Ukraine, Russian forces have taken control of the city of Vuhledar, along with 2 more frontline villages. Meanwhile, Ukraine's top prosecutor says he's investigating the murder of 16 Ukrainian prisoners of war, alleging they were summarily executed after they were surrendered to Russian forces on the Eastern Front. In Brussels, Belgium, the former Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte was sworn in as Secretary General of NATO Tuesday. In his inaugural speech, he pledged to shore up Western support of Ukraine and warned China over its growing ties with Russia.
Through its support for Russia's military industry, China has become a decisive enabler of Russia's war in Ukraine. China cannot continue to fuel the largest conflict in Europe since the Second World War without this impacting its interests and reputation.
The White House has approved an additional $567 million in U.S. military aid to Taiwan, the largest such aid package ever. Its approval came as Chinese authorities led celebrations marking the 75th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. Chinese leader Xi Jinping spoke from Beijing.
Taiwan is a sacred territory of China, and the people on both sides of the Taiwan Strait are connected by blood, which is thicker than water.
President Xi warned against separatist activities, as he put it, in Taiwan, and said its reunification with China is inevitable. Claudia Sheinbaum was sworn in as Mexico's first female president Tuesday, pledging her 6-year term will be a time for transformation. Sheinbaum has vowed to strengthen women's rights in Mexico, which is one of the highest rates of femicide, to expand access to public health care and education and other social reforms that have been bolstered by the ruling Morena Party. Sheinbaum received the baton of power from indigenous and Afro-Mexican women who joined her on stage as she addressed thousands of supporters gathered in Mexico City's Zócalo Square.
I am certain that power is honesty and humility, that our thinking is Mexican humanism, that our nation and people are great, and I am certain we are the only option that represents well-being and progress with justice.
Here in the United States, the death toll from Hurricane Helene has surpassed 166 people across 6 states, with hundreds still missing, more than 5 days after the storm triggered devastating floods and landslides. Massive power outages continue to impact over 1.3 million customers. In eastern Tennessee, at least 6 plastic factory workers are missing and presumed dead after floodwater swelled around their workplace, trapping the group of predominantly Latinx workers who for hours clung to the back of a semi-truck before they were swept away by the deluge. Some family members report the employer, Impact Plastics, told the workers not to evacuate and threatened to fire anyone who left ahead of the storm. This is Robert Jarvis, one of the survivors.
What would you say to the company?
Why'd you make us work that day? Why?
We shouldn't have worked. We shouldn't have been there. None of us should have been there. And that's what I should have said to them.
Hurricane Helene has become the second deadliest hurricane after Katrina. The state of Texas has put another prisoner to death. On Tuesday, 61-year-old Garcia Glenn White was strapped to a gurney in the state penitentiary in Huntsville and injected with a single lethal dose of the drug pentobarbital. It was the 6th execution carried out in the United States in the last 11 days. An investigation by the U.S. Department of Justice has found violence and sexual assault are rife in prisons across Georgia, constituting cruel and unusual punishment for the state's estimated 50,000 incarcerated people. The scathing report by the DOJ's Civil Rights Division found Georgia fails to protect people in custody from extreme violence inside 34 state prisons, as well as 4 prisons run by for-profit corporate contractors. It also found an unconstitutional risk of harm from sexual violence at these prisons, including widespread sexual assaults of LGBTQ plus people. Assistant Attorney General Kristen Clark leads the Justice Department Civil Rights Division.
In America, time in prison should not be a sentence to death, torture, or rape. We can't turn a blind eye to the wretched conditions and wanton violence unfolding in these institutions. The people incarcerated in these jails and prisons are our neighbors, siblings, children, parents, family members, and friends.
And the Justice Department has announced a federal investigation in the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre after Oklahoma Supreme Court in June dismissed a lawsuit brought by two elderly survivors. No one's ever been charged over the murders of an estimated 300 black people who were killed when a white mob burned down what was known as Black Wall Street, the thriving African-American neighborhood of Greenwood. The Justice Department will probe the killings under the Emmett Till Unsolved Civil Rights Crime Act, which gives the federal government the power to reopen civil rights-related cold cases. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's announced it's sending more troops into southern Lebanon as the Middle East moves closer to a full-scale regional war. On Tuesday, Iran fired at least 180 ballistic missiles at Israel, an attack that Iran said targeted Israeli military and security sites. Video online shows some of the missiles striking at or near the Nevatim Air Base, which houses Israel's U.S.-made F-35 fighter jets. Israel's vowing to retaliate. Israel says the only death from the attacks was a Palestinian man who was killed by falling debris in the occupied West Bank in Jericho. President Biden responded to the Iran attack by saying the United States will help Israel, quote, exact severe consequences, unquote. On Tuesday, United States aided Israel in intercepting many of the Iranian missiles. Iran's attack came in response to Israel's escalating attacks on Lebanon and Israel's assassination of Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah on Friday. There have been a number of other developments in the region. In southern Lebanon, Hezbollah fighters are claiming they attacked Israeli troops near the town of Odessa. Two Israeli soldiers were killed, 18 others wounded. Earlier today, Hezbollah denounced Israel for bombing the offices of Al-Sirat, a television network based outside of Beirut. In Gaza, Al Jazeera reports Israeli forces have killed at least 79 Palestinians over the past day alone. In Tel Aviv, Israeli police said seven people died in a shooting and stabbing attack on Tuesday. Police said the attack was carried out by two men from the occupied West Bank. One was shot dead, the other seriously wounded. And at the United Nations here in New York, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres issued a terse statement saying, quote, I condemn the broadening of the Middle East conflict with escalation after escalation. This must stop. We absolutely need a ceasefire, he said. Earlier today, Israeli Foreign Minister Israel Katz announced he's banning the UN Secretary General from entering Israel, saying he's, quote, persona non grata due to his unwillingness to condemn Iran, unquote. We're joined now by two guests. Akbar Shahid Ahmed is the senior diplomatic correspondent for HuffPost. He's based in Washington, D.C. And in Tel Aviv, we're joined by the Israeli political analyst Ori Goldberg, who's written extensively on Iran and Israel. His recent piece for New Lines magazine is titled Why Israelis Do and Don't Want War with Hezbollah. Ori, let's begin with you in Tel Aviv. Can you talk about what yesterday was like in Tel Aviv with the 180 missiles, what happened to them, how many you understand were intercepted, and then what Israel is promising to do next?
Yesterday was scary. I spent 40 or 45 minutes with my three children and our dog in a shelter. There were many explosions that we could hear. We had no idea what was happening, but reports began to come out almost immediately that there were no casualties except for that one unfortunate Palestinian. From what I can gather, the Iranian assertion about targeting military and security facilities is correct all over the country, including in the center near Tel Aviv and in the Tel Aviv suburbs. Such facilities were the targets. There were some civilian homes that were hit by bomb blasts. Once again, it was scary, but it was also compounded by the horrible attack in Jaffa and by a general sense that while things were supposedly in control, while Israel was going from glory to glory, killing its enemies and getting the bad guys, there was also a deep sense of insecurity and a lack of control right at home. The Jaffa attack was quite traumatic. It still hasn't really been covered extensively in the Israeli press, except for providing the names of some of the casualties. But generally, the sense was that Israel was not in control. I think that was one of the reasons for Prime Minister Netanyahu's various statements about Iran having committed a grave mistake and about how Israel will punish it and retaliate. Generally, there's this sense of a surreal reality, if you will, where on the one hand, Israel, again, seems to be doing great things and going great guns and finally getting some closure and fighting terrorism. But on the other hand, there's a sense of impending doom and inevitability of this impending doom when it comes to Israel's potential actions in the future.
An AJ Plus, Al Jazeera Plus reporter, Mohammed Al-Safan, wrote in social media, quote, Israeli journalists and most Western journalists in Israel are abiding by the Israeli military censor, so this is a very useful thread. It seems like Nevatim got hit very hard. It's the base where U.S. munitions are sent. Ori Goldberg, your response.
I would assume that's true. Of course, as Israeli citizens, we're not entitled to know the results and implications of the Iranian strike. These bits of information are heavily censored, as are, by the way, reports about what is happening to Israeli forces in Lebanon. Again, the Iranians have shown, and they already showed in April, that they are quite aware of where Israel's main security facilities are. And their use of ballistic missiles this time apparently made it easier for them to create further impact. Many of the missiles were intercepted, but certainly not all of them. It also seems like the Iranians knew exactly what they were doing. This wasn't an inaccurate attack or not an indication of Iranian weakness, as some official Israeli spokespersons have tried to suggest. This was actually quite an accurate attack. And in that sense, I don't think it was a retaliation to the assassination of Nasrallah. I actually think of it more as a shot across the bow. I think the Iranians were concerned profoundly. And I think one of the reasons that the IRGC and the generals in Tehran won the day and persuaded the Supreme Leader to retaliate after having lost to the Republicans, pragmatists, moderates, call them what you will, who had, since Ismail Haniyeh's assassination, convinced the leader not to retaliate. The reason there was a retaliation this time is because I think they were genuinely concerned that Israel might strike in Iran after it was done with Lebanon. I think, again, this was meant as a shot across the bow, as a message to Israel saying, calm yourselves, right? Take a breather. Will Israel retaliate? Likely. I think this is being decided right now in strenuous dialogue between D.C. and Jerusalem. But in the Iranian case, I really think this was not meant as a declaration of war. I think the nature of the attack demonstrates that quite effectively. I think it was meant as a message to Israel. I don't know if that message was received.
On Tuesday, President Biden said, quote, based on what we know now, the attack appears to have been defeated and ineffective. He added the U.S. military actively supported Israel's defense. Biden added, make no mistake, the United States is fully, fully, fully supportive of Israel. Can you talk about, Ori, the U.S. role in the region from arming Israel's assault on Gaza last night? And there was almost no news of this in the mainstream U.S. corporate media. 79 people killed in the last, 24 hours in Gaza. So that assault continues. From what's going on in Gaza to calling Israel's assassination of the Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah a measure of justice, if you could comment.
The U.S. role in enabling Israel's campaign in Gaza and Israel's rampage in Lebanon at the moment is undoubtedly crucial. The U.S. has allowed Israel to do this, just as it could have stopped Israel from doing it, and it decided not to do that. I think there are various reasons for America's or the Biden administration's support for Israel. I think a lot of them, again, have to do with historical baggage and with patterns seemingly set in stone after 76 years of Israel's existence. I think it's very, very hard to shake off old habits. I will assume that a Harris administration will not adopt the approach that the Biden administration adopted. Having said that, I think there's a real debate right now among the punditry about whether Gaza itself was a platform for initiating and generating a regional war with Iran at the behest of the United States in cooperation with Israel, or whether this is the result of ongoing escalation where there is less strategy and less forethought. I tend towards the second school. Looking at Israel's behavior, I fail to discern any kind of plan and perhaps even any rhyme or reason in the way Israel has been acting. Israel has always adopted a very tactical mindset. We've never excelled at strategy. This time around, it seems like Israel approached what was happening in Lebanon as an attempt at redemption. That's certainly true for the IDF after the year of spectacular failures in Gaza. But also, I think Israel found itself in tactical heaven, having managed to assassinate Nasrallah. Suddenly, a lot of other targets were surfacing. And it's very important to understand that this is the way Israel approaches developing situations on the ground in the Middle East. Israel looks for targets. If these people surface, Israel hits them. Consequences, implications, midterm, definitely long-term considerations, these are usually almost completely irrelevant. Israel focuses on closure. I know that's a little hard to accept when thinks of Israel as a strategic powerhouse, but it really isn't. And precedent, again, on the ground seems to suggest that that is true. As for the United States, I think the United States has a very bad history with Hezbollah specifically, and the United States has a long memory that goes back to the embassy suicide bombing attack in 1983. And that I think, explains why the Biden administration spoke of Nasrallah's assassination as a measure of justice. However, this strategy or this reasoning seems to be imploding because for the first time, Lebanon finds itself without a militia powerful enough to hold the country together. I think neither the United States nor Israel consider the implications of Israel's rampage. I think they're standing before a situation that could very rapidly devolve into war. However, one last point, this war will likely not be a ground war. It won't be that sort of offensive. It will be a projectile war based on missiles for some time yet. I don't think the U.S. is, I don't think the U.S. desires that kind of war. I think that's true for both a Harris administration and a Trump administration. And again, I expect that in the conversations being held right now between Washington and Jerusalem, there is an attempt to find some sort of a retaliatory measure for Israel that will not escalate this further.
During last night's CBS News vice presidential debate here in New York, Republican Senator J.D. Vance, Minnesota's Democratic Governor Tim Walz, both voiced support for Israel, but Walz criticized Donald Trump for pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal. This is what he said.
When Donald Trump was in office, it was Donald Trump who we had a coalition of nations that had boxed Iran's nuclear program in, the inability to advance it. Donald Trump pulled that program and put nothing else in its place. So Iran is closer to a nuclear weapon than they were before because of Donald Trump's fickle leadership. And when Iran shot down an American aircraft in international airspace, Donald Trump tweeted, because that's the standard diplomacy of Donald Trump. And when Iranian missiles did fall near U.S. troops and they received traumatic brain injuries, Donald Trump wrote it off as headaches.
Senator Vance, the U.S. did have a diplomatic deal with Iran to temporarily pause parts of its nuclear program, and President Trump did exit that deal. He recently said, just 5 days ago, the U.S. must now make a diplomatic deal with Iran because the consequences are impossible. Did he make a mistake? You have 1 minute.
Well, first of all, Margaret, diplomacy is not a dirty word, but I think that something that Governor Waltz just said is quite extraordinary. You yourself just said Iran is as close to a nuclear weapon today as they have ever been. And Governor Waltz, you blame Donald Trump, who has been the vice president for the last 3.5 years. And the answer is your running mate, not mine. Donald Trump consistently made the world more secure.
That's Senator Vance, and before him, Tim Walz. Akbar Shahid Ahmed also joins us, senior diplomatic correspondent for HuffPost. He's in Washington, D.C. His recent piece headlined, Israel's preparing a risky incursion into Lebanon as Biden stands by. And he's working on a book on the Biden administration's Gaza policy called Crossing the Red Line. Akbar, if you can respond to the U.S. President Biden, the Biden-Harris administration's response to what's happening in Israel, Gaza, Lebanon, and with Iran right now.
Thanks, Amy. The Biden administration is in a place they definitely did not want to be a year ago at the start of this war, right? They thought they were going to prevent a regional war, demonstrate support for Israel, and not pay a huge political cost. On all those fronts, they've largely failed, other than arguably demonstrating support for Israel. Where they are now is they feel, look, we are 5 weeks from a presidential election. We don't want to be seen as abandoning a U.S. partner. So they're really emphasizing the sense of we're defending Israel. But I think it gets to something Ori was talking about, which is there a strategy here or is this just tactics, right? The administration can say, look, we've stopped Israelis from being killed. We've sent Israel defensive and huge offensive equipment. But where are they actually going and how are they de-escalating tensions? That was something we didn't see from Governor Waltz. It's not something we've heard from the Biden administration as Israel has begun its ground invasion of Lebanon. And I think when we're at a point where there's 40,000 and a growing number of U.S. troops in the region, and there is a sense that Israel's actions are inextricably linked to a green light from the U.S., there's a real responsibility for Washington here. From their point of view, for Biden administration officials, there is an internal debate. Many are extremely cautious and are saying, look, this is the moment to try to use our leverage over Israel, which is overwhelming and unique, to rein them in. But there is a small and very influential segment, Amy, of hawkish Biden administration advisors who say, look, Israel has decimated Hezbollah's leadership to a large degree. We dislike Iran. We don't want them to have so much influence in the region. Why not sort of keep escalating further? The question is, where does that lead us? And I think the administration hasn't given us an answer yet.
What's going on in the White House? Who are the parties around Biden? And what role does Kamala Harris play, the vice president?
Yeah, I think the closest person to President Biden on these matters is someone called Brett McGurk. This is the White House Middle East coordinator. He's not a well-known figure in the way that, say, Secretary of State Tony Blinken is. But he is someone who in many ways is emblematic of U.S. foreign policy thinking in the Middle East over the last 20 years, right? Which many folks would say is a pretty dubious record. This is someone who came up in the Bush administration administering Iraq. He's very much pushing the let's kneecap Iran right now. And this is our moment. I think there's folks at the Pentagon, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, Secretary of State Blinken, are to a degree more cautious. But this internal debate is so being fought in the room with the president personally. And what we know and what we've seen from the president publicly is he wants to yet again demonstrate support for Israel publicly. And it's not clear, even privately, if he's considering any route of using the influence he has, right? Of saying, okay, we will not give you U.S. military equipment. We will pull back some of our troops from the region. Inside the White House, there's also a lot of anxiety about Vice President Harris's electoral prospects, as you can imagine. There's a real sense that they've made a decision on the Gaza ceasefire question and the broader question of the Middle East, which is they're not going to make a huge diplomatic push before the election. This idea they had that they were going to achieve a deal, bring home hostages, send aid to Palestinians, stop the bombing and the starvation, that's all out the window at this point, right? The shiny new thing is a Lebanon incursion, opportunity, and sort of hoping Gaza doesn't reach the top headlines. But I think that's where you get to a point of risk where Senator Vance was able at the vice presidential debate to say the world looks pretty chaotic right now, and it's not former President Trump who's in charge. It is President Biden. And that's an argument that the Trump campaign is very deliberately using to reach out to Americans in the middle and specific groups who feel alienated, whether it's Arab Americans, Muslim Americans, younger voters. And polls do show us recently, Amy, that an increasing majority of Americans are worried about a growing war and want to see greater U.S. diplomacy. We're not seeing a greater public demand for more weapons or more troops being sent to the region.
And what about the possibility, do you see, of Israel striking Iran, specifically perhaps nuclear sites?
You know, I'll think back to a pretty scary phrase I heard from a well-placed U.S. official, Korea bureaucrat working on Middle East policy. This person said to me at the beginning of this week, you know, they described how people inside government who track these issues are, quote, stunned and shocked. And then they said, we feel we're enabling a, quote, nihilistic regional murder spree. Now, that's very strong language, right? A murder spree. But what it tells you is that there's a real sense within government that the U.S. is not going to provide a veto on Israeli actions. I think there is concern about, does it strike nuclear sites and does Iran lash back in a way that's impossible to control? That the sense of a no from the U.S., I think, is very questionable. It's not a guarantee. What you could see the U.S. doing is urge Israel to strike something that looks strategic, but is not necessarily a red line for the Iranians where they feel they have to respond to a huge degree. But that carries its own risks. You've seen the Iranians come out and say, not only would be in response to target Israel, we would target U.S. partners across the region and potentially cripple the global economy, right? They've talked about targeting Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, other partners who are critical to end global energy supplies. So I think the U.S. doesn't know where it's going, but its commitment is very clear in that it wants to send a message to Iran that's overwhelming and military.
Akbar Shahid Ahmed, I want to ask you to stay with us as we talk more about the debate, particularly the last response of J.D. Vance around the issue of January 6th and the insurrection and President Trump's attempt to overturn the 2020 election. We'll also be talking about abortion and climate change and more. Akbar is the senior diplomatic correspondent for HuffPost, joining us from D.C. We'll link to your pieces on Lebanon and Gaza. And we want to thank Ori Goldberg for joining us. Ori Goldberg, Israeli political analyst and scholar who's written extensively on Iran, Israel, and the relationship between religion and politics in the Middle East. We'll link to your piece in New Lines magazine, Why Israelis Do and Don't Want War with Hezbollah. Your recent piece for The Nation, for Israeli protesters, Palestine Might as Well Not Exist. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, the vice presidential debate. Stay with us. رجال الله في الميدان ووعد صادق أنتم وأنتم نصرنا الآتي وأنتم من جبال الشمس عاتية على العاتي ووعد صادق أنتم وأنتم نصرنا الآتي وأنتم من جبال My beloved ones by Julie Boutros. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. We continue our look at last night's vice presidential debate between Minnesota Democratic Governor Tim Walz and Ohio Republican Senator J.D. Vance, facing off in New York in their first and only debate ahead of the election. We'll be spending the rest of the hour airing excerpts and getting analysis. Near the end of the debate, the discussion turned to the January 6th insurrection and Donald Trump's attempts to overturn the 2020 election. J.D. Vance was asked if he would challenge this year's election results, even if every governor certifies the results.
Look, what President Trump has said is that there were problems in 2020. And my own belief is that we should fight about those issues, debate those issues peacefully in the public square. And that's all I've said. And that's all that Donald Trump has said. Remember, he said that on January the 6th, the protesters ought to protest peacefully. And on January the 20th, what happened? Joe Biden became the president. Donald Trump left the White House. And now, of course, unfortunately, we have all of the negative policies that have come from the Harris-Biden administration. I believe that we actually do have a threat to democracy in this country, but unfortunately, it's not the threat to democracy that Kamala Harris and Tim Walz want to talk about. It is the threat of censorship.
This one is troubling to me, and I say that because I think we need to tell the story. Donald Trump refused to acknowledge this, and the fact is that I don't think we can be the frog in the pot and let the boiling water go up. He was very clear. I mean, he lost this election, and he said he didn't. 140 police officers were beaten at the Capitol that day, some with the American flag. Several later died. And it wasn't just in there. In Minnesota, a group gathered on the state Capitol grounds in St. Paul and said, "We're marching to the governor's residence and there may be casualties." The only person there was my son and his dog, who was rushed out crying by state police. That issue and Mike Pence standing there as they were chanting, "Hang Mike Pence." Mike Pence made the right decision. So, Senator, it was adjudicated over and over and over. This is one that we are miles apart on. This was a threat to our democracy in a way that we had not seen. And it manifested itself because of Donald Trump's inability to say. He is still saying he didn't lose the election. I would just ask that. Did he lose the 2020 election?
Tim, I'm focused on the future. Did Kamala Harris censor Americans from speaking their mind in the wake of the 2020 COVID situation?
That is a damning non-answer.
That was Tim Walz and J.D. Vance, an excerpt of the CBS vice presidential debate moderated by Nora O'Donnell and Margaret Brennan. Still with us, Akbar Shahid Ahmed, senior diplomatic correspondent for HuffPost based in Washington, D.C. Maybe the most dramatic moment of this debate coming right at the end there. Your response, Akbar.
I think this certainly is the moment that the Harris campaign will be hoping becomes the defining moment of the night. They've already come out and said that based on their analysis of swing voters, this was the moment that turned people off Senator J.D. Vance and by extension Donald Trump. I think what's so interesting about the Senator's answer is that it's so stripped of context, right? Historically, J.D. Vance has said, "I would have helped Donald Trump remain in power." And he said, "Had I been Mike Pence in that moment, I would not have certified the election results." Additionally, we know that Republicans at a state level across the country, not just Donald Trump, but all the way down through the party, are pushing these kind of stop-the-steal theories, these ideas that non-citizens are voting, these extensive restrictions, strange ways to kind of increase executive power over the process and inject politics into what's historically been a nonpartisan voting process. So what we know is that Republicans have laid the groundwork to challenge elections again and again, whether it's Donald Trump on the ballot or not. I think this will be the moment that will be referenced repeatedly in the future. J.D. Vance, having made other points he thinks get through to people better, definitely, I'm sure, was grateful that this came at the end and hopes that maybe people by that point had switched off and turned away.
Well, I want to go now to the part of the debate where they took on the climate crisis. The debate took place here in New York as the death toll from Hurricane Helene has reached at least 166. President Biden's expected to visit the Carolinas today, while Vice President Kamala Harris will be in Georgia. During the debate, J.D. Vance described climate change as weird science and expressed skepticism about the scientific consensus linking rising carbon emissions to the climate crisis.
I think it's important for us, first of all, to say Donald Trump and I support clean air, clean water. We want the environment to be cleaner and safer. But one of the things that I've noticed some of our Democratic friends talking a lot about is a concern about carbon emissions, this idea that carbon emissions drives all of the climate change. Well, let's just say that's true, just for the sake of argument, so we're not arguing about weird science. Let's just say that's true. Well, if you believe that, what would you want to do? The answer is that you'd want to reshore as much American manufacturing as possible, and you'd want to produce as much energy as possible in the United States of America, because we're the cleanest economy in the entire world.
Now, look, coming back to the climate change issue, there's no doubt this thing roared onto the scene faster and stronger than anything we've seen. Senator Vance has said that there's a climate problem in the past. Donald Trump called it a hoax and then joked that these things would make more beachfront property to be able to invest in. What we've seen out of the Harris administration now, the Biden-Harris administration, is we've seen this investment. We've seen massive investments, the biggest in global history that we've seen in the Inflation Reduction Act, has created jobs all across the country. 2,000 in Jeffersonville, Ohio, taking the EV technology that we invented and making it here. 200,000 jobs across the country. The largest solar manufacturing plant in North America sets in Minnesota. But my farmers know climate change is real. They've seen 500-year droughts, 500-year floods back to back.
That was Democratic vice presidential nominee Governor Tim Walz and his Republican challenger, J.D. Vance. Prior to the debate, six youth climate activists were arrested outside CBS headquarters here in New York in a protest calling on the moderators to ask a question about Hurricane Helene and the climate crisis.
I'm fighting for the millions of people who are without power, who have died in this hurricane, because big oil is ruining our futures and killing us.
We're joined now by Shiva Rajbhandari, a student climate justice organizer at UNC Chapel Hill. That's the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, spokesperson for the Sunrise Movement, which had also urged CBS to include a question about Hurricane Helene and climate change. Shiva, thanks so much for joining us. You're in heavily hit state by Hurricane Helene. This is, what, the deadliest hurricane in something like 20 years next to Katrina. Talk about the protest and how you feel the two vice presidential candidates responded.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Amy. And that's right. Hurricane Helene is one of the worst climate disasters we've seen in years, certainly this year. Over 160 American lives have been lost, and hundreds, like you said earlier in the show, remain missing right here in North Carolina. And so it is truly a climate disaster caused by big oil. And I think, you know, it gives me a lot of fear for what's to come. First of all, I think the fact that this question was asked, especially in the way that it was asked, it was a major win for our movement. We called on Nora O'Donnell and CBS to prioritize climate. We said, hey, millions of young people across the country care about climate change. It's a voting issue for many, many people. But not only that, it is front of mind for millions more here in the Southeast, where Hurricane Helene has wreaked havoc. From Tampa Bay, Florida, where I was earlier this weekend helping with disaster response, all the way up to the mountains of Appalachia. And I think the response that the candidates gave was telling. First of all, we saw that J.D. Vance, you know, was unable to stand up to Donald Trump's words, just like he was throughout the debate. You know, he refused to say whether he thought climate change was a hoax, and he wouldn't talk about climate disasters like the major threat to American lives like he would just a few years ago. And I think that's demonstrative of a critical error with J.D. Vance and the Trump-Vance campaign, is that J.D. Vance has no backbone. He is unwilling to stand up to Donald Trump. He is unwilling to, you know, disagree with his running mate. And that is dangerous, not just for the success of, like, a Vance-Trump presidency, but for American democracy as a whole, especially when dealing with a wannabe dictator like Donald Trump, who is essentially sold out to big oil, right? He's a billionaire, and I truly believe he would sell young people just down the river for a couple bucks or just to hang on to power for a little while longer. I think the response that we saw from Tim Walz was strong, but still fell short of my needs as a young person and as a climate justice organizer. You know, we know that climate policies are popular. The Green New Deal is popular. And Tim Walz didn't need to distance himself from that. This all of the above energy strategy is a strategy for death, ultimately.
And Shiva, we need a Harris Walz administration
that's going to take rapid action to stop the climate crisis. We have less than 6 years, and I've seen no plan.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. Shiva Rajandhari, student climate justice organizer at UNC Chapel Hill, spokesperson for the Sunrise Movement, which is not officially endorsing Harris, citing a lack of a detailed climate agenda, but has a major campaign aimed at mobilizing 1.5 million young voters to support Harris for president. Coming up, we look at the vice presidential debate issues of immigration and abortion. Back in 20 seconds.
Upload a two-party system. Well, that's up to dangers, illusion of choice. Download a form of fascism. Nothing really ever changes. You never had a voice.
Colonize Mind by Prince. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. During Tuesday's vice presidential debate, Governor Tim Walz criticized Senator J.D. Vance and Donald Trump for demonizing Haitians living in the city of Springfield, Ohio. The city's been in the national spotlight since Donald Trump made these remarks in his debate with Kamala Harris.
In Springfield, they're eating the dogs, the people that came in. They're eating the cats. They're eating the pets of the people that live there.
J.D. Vance has made similar claims despite protests by local Republican officials who say the stories are not true. On Tuesday night, Governor Walz criticized Trump and Vance's comments while answering a question from debate moderator Margaret Brennan of CBS.
Governor, what about our CBS News polling, which does show that a majority of Americans, more than 50%, support mass deportations?
Look, we fixed this issue with a bill that is necessary, but the issue on this is what happens when you don't want to solve it. You demonize it. And we saw this. And Senator Vance, and it surprises me on this, talking about and saying, I will create stories to bring attention to this. That vilified a large number of people who were here legally in the community of Springfield. The Republican governor said, it's not true. Don't do it. There's consequences for this. There's consequences. We could come together. Senator Lankford did it. We could come together and solve this if we didn't let Donald Trump continue to make it an issue. And the consequences in Springfield were the governor had to send state law enforcement to escort kindergartners to school. I believe Senator Vance wants to solve this, but by standing with Donald Trump and not working together to find a solution, it becomes a talking point. And when it becomes a talking point like this, we dehumanize and villainize other human beings.
Now, Governor Walz brought up the community of Springfield, and he's very worried about the things that I've said in Springfield. Look, in Springfield, Ohio, and in communities all across this country, you've got schools that are overwhelmed. You've got hospitals that are overwhelmed. You've got housing that is totally unaffordable because we brought in millions of illegal immigrants to compete with Americans for scarce homes. The people that I'm most worried about in Springfield, Ohio, are the American citizens who have had their lives destroyed by Kamala Harris's open border. It is a disgrace, Tim. And I actually think I agree with you. I think you want to solve this problem, but I don't think that Kamala Harris does.
Very interestingly, further on in this debate, J.D. Vance complained about the fact-checking. Margaret Brennan of CBS said, just to clarify for our viewers, Springfield, Ohio does have a large number of Haitian migrants who have legal status, temporary protected status, she said. Vance spoke up to complain about the fact-check. He said, Margaret, the rules were that you were not going to fact-check, and since you're fact-checking me, I think it's important to say what's actually going on, he protested. Well, we're joined right now by Gerline Joseph, co-founder and executive director of Haitian Bridge Alliance, which recently used an Ohio state law to bring criminal charges against Trump and Vance over their false claims. Gerline, welcome back to Democracy Now! As they were making these claims, we interviewed you when you came to New York. Now you're in Washington, D.C. You've met with many public officials. Can you respond to what they said, and particularly this criminal complaint you've brought against Trump and Vance in Ohio for endangering the Haitian community?
Thank you so much, Amy. And the reality is they continue to spread those lies even after we have brought criminal charges against them. They must be held accountable. What they are doing, as we have seen over the past few weeks, is creating chaos, creating division, and really making an environment of fear, not only in Springfield, Ohio, in Charleroi, Pennsylvania, in Long Island, New York, in places in California. We cannot allow this to continue, Amy. We have lives at risk. Real people's lives are at risk. And the Haitian community in Springfield and around the country, along with our allies and the people of America, are standing up to say enough is enough. So this criminal charge that we have brought against Mr. Trump and Mr. Vance is really to hold them accountable, make sure that they understand that they are not above the law, and what they are doing is unacceptable as people who are seeking to be really leading this country forward. This cannot be the case.
And can you also talk about what's happened as early as a week ago or less than a week ago, the continued deportations of Haitians back into Haiti, where now, according to the World Food Program, something like one in two people, half the population is suffering severe hunger, not to mention violence.
Thank you, Amy. And I want to make it clear that the Haitian Bridge Alliance is a nonpartisan organization. We have lawsuit filed against President Biden for what happened in Del Rio. And we continue to push back against deportation that President Biden and his administration continues today to Haiti. As you just mentioned, as we see that we continue to deal with extreme political turmoil in Haiti and the famine that is happening right now. And President Biden in his administration continues to deport Haitians, immigrants to Haiti right now. So we are calling on President Biden and his administration to stop the deportation, while we are also calling on Mr. Vance and Mr. Trump to be held accountable for the criminal acts that they continue to terrorize a community and the entire country, for that matter of fact.
Gerline Joseph, I want to thank you for being with us, co-founder and executive director of Haitian Bridge Alliance. As we continue to look at last night's CBS News vice presidential debate, we turn to the issue of abortion. This is Republican Senator J.D. Vance.
Now, of course, Donald Trump has been very clear that on the abortion policy specifically, that we have a big country and it's diverse. And California has a different viewpoint on this than Georgia. Georgia has a different viewpoint from Arizona. And the proper way to handle this, as messy as democracy sometimes is to let voters make these decisions, let the individual states make their abortion policy. And I think that's what makes the most sense in a very big, a very diverse, and let's be honest, sometimes a very, very messy and divided country.
Governor, would you like to respond and also answer the question about restrictions?
Yeah, well, the question got asked, and Donald Trump made the accusation that wasn't true about Minnesota. Well, let me tell you about this idea that there's diverse states. There's a young woman named Amber Thurman. She happened to be in Georgia, a restrictive state. Because of that, she had to travel a long distance to North Carolina to try and get her care. Amber Thurman died in that journey back and forth. The fact of the matter is, how can we as a nation say that your life and your rights, as basic as the right to control your own body, is determined on geography? There's a very real chance, had Amber Thurman lived in Minnesota, she would be alive today.
So that's Walls. Before that, J.D. Vance. Amy Littlefield is abortion access correspondent at The Nation, independent journalist who covers reproductive health, joining us from Boston. Your response to this discussion and the stance of these candidates?
I thought it was so powerful, Amy, to hear Amber Thurman's name from the debate stage, right? 2 weeks after ProPublica published the report that this young mother had had to travel to North Carolina for an abortion. She'd suffered a complication that's rare when she was back home in Georgia. And because the state of Georgia had made the simple procedure that would have saved her life a felony, she died and left behind a six-year-old child. You know, Walls also could have mentioned Candy Miller, who ProPublica reported who had died with her three-year-old daughter by her side after suffering the same rare complication in a state that banned abortion at 6 weeks. Worth noting, Amy, by the way, that a judge in Georgia just this week struck down the state's six-week abortion ban as unconstitutional, the law that killed Amber Thurman. You know, I have to say, Amy, watching this debate, I felt like I was in a nightmare version of my high school sex ed class, watching, you know, Coach Tim Walls chastise the smug kid in the back of the room who had gotten caught copying off of his classmate's paper, because what J.D. Vance seemed to be doing in this debate, and frankly, he was very good at it, is trying to co-opt the Democratic talking points that sometimes on abortion and trying to make his stance look moderate, because quite frankly, his own hardline position on abortion has flunked with the American people. You know, he got everyone from Taylor Swift and beyond mad at him, and, you know, cats and women, we don't forget, Amy. We know where J.D. Vance stands on abortion. We know that he spent his Saturday hanging out with leaders of the new Apostolic Reformation, a far-right strain of Christianity that believes that people like you and I who espouse anything that looks left-leaning are literally infested with demons that need to be vanquished through spiritual warfare. This is the kind of company that J.D. Vance keeps. But I'm going to say probably the most terrifying words I've ever said on this program before, Amy, which is J.D. Vance sounded good at trying to convince us that he was more moderate than he actually is on the issue of abortion. Because unlike Donald Trump, J.D. Vance seems quite skilled at code switching. And I have to say, I think the three most frightening words that J.D. Vance said from the debate stage were, "I am 40." Okay? Unlike Donald Trump, not only is he good at code switching and hiding what he actually believes, but J.D. Vance is going to be with us for a long time.
Yeah, I wanted to go to something that was on Vance's website. In July, Jennifer Bendery, the senior politics reporter for HuffPo, tweeted a screenshot from Vance's Senate campaign website before it was wiped that described his views on abortion under the all-caps title, End Abortion. That was on his website. It read in part, "Eliminating abortion is first and foremost about protecting the unborn, but it's also about making our society more pro-child, more pro-family. The historic Dobbs decision puts this new era of society into motion, one that prioritizes family and the sanctity of life." And then last night, Trump tweeted during and after the debate, and it seems like it's the first time he said this, "I would not support a federal abortion ban under any circumstances, would in fact veto it because he wants the states to decide." Your response?
Right. I mean, we know that Vance has said he's sympathetic to the idea that a national abortion ban would be needed to prevent women from traveling out of state in order to seek an abortion. Right. We know that Vance has said of rape and incest exceptions that two wrongs don't make a right. We know, you know, that he is hardline when it comes to being anti-abortion. We know the strategy here because they wrote it down. It's in a more than 900-page document called Project 2025 that talks about the need to ban abortion nationwide, not using an act of Congress or the people, but using the 1873 Comstock Act and reviving that as a de facto ban on mailing abortion pills. So, you know, we have to look at the strategy here and not get distracted by the slick talking points.
And finally, this all happened yesterday. Well, Louisiana instituted the first in the nation law that bans abortion medications, calling them dangerous. And they are used for a number of different issues. The significance of this in 15 seconds.
I mean, we have to look at the recent report from Pregnancy Justice that found that there was a record high number of instances of pregnancy-related prosecutions over the year after the Dobbs decision, at least 210. So this is a collision of the war on drugs with anti-abortion policies that always affects low-income people and the most marginal people first.
Amy Littlefield, abortion access correspondent at The Nation, an independent journalist who covers reproductive health. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Will be doing a four-hour election night special on November 5th, followed by a two-hour morning show the next day. Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Tammy Warrenoff. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, this is Brendan Canning from Broken Social Scene. You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, Canada.
CFRC 101.9 FM has new social media. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at CFRC Music and keep up with the latest announcements about our programming and projects. Follow us today at CFRC Music.
Are you representing yourself in family court? The Queen's Family Law Clinic helps people with low income who cannot afford lawyers. The clinic assists self-representing family court litigants by completing their documents, helping them negotiate the family court process, and referring them to other family justice resources. Services include applications and motions for things such as custody, access, and child support, and assistance completing a wide range of court forms.